This is Live at Politics and Prose, a program from Slate and Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C., featuring some of today's best writers and top thinkers.
It is a very deep pleasure for me to welcome Helen MacDonald to Politics and Prose for H is for Hawk and her collection of poetry, Shaler's Fish. I hardly need to recount to all of you the long list of plaudits for this New York Times bestselling book, top 10 award winner, winner of the Samuel Johnson Prize, and the Costa Book of the Year. Helen's story of her grief over her father's death and the solace she found in her relationship with her hawk Mabel is destined to be a classic of nature writing. But my favorite thing about it is how unclassical, how untidy it is. It is simultaneously, in a good way, in a wonderful way, right? It is simultaneously a memoir, a field guide, and as she calls it, a shadow memoir of T.H. White. The lessons are not easy, and they happen slowly and cyclically. There are no light bulb moments or easy revelations. And Helen has the bravery in this book to admit the flaws in her process, and that in the end, no matter how connected they are, that she and Mabel are not the same, and that she, unlike her hawk, is bound to this earth. Her attentive attachment to nature and her diverse knowledge also inform her collection, Shaler's Fish, written before H is for Hawk, but only now being seen for the first time in the States. If you haven't read them, these are full-blooded poems, poems you need to read twice, even three times, to get to the marrow of them, and each reading they gather in intensity and force. For fans of Helen's writing, like myself and all of you here, it's thrilling to get to hear her indulge in language for language's sake, no longer in the service of anything but itself. Please help me welcome Helen MacDonald to Politics and Prose.
Thank you. To use a Britishism, look at you all. Bloody hell. So many people. Thank you so much for coming. Can you hear me okay? Okay, that's great. Oh, that's good. My best Radio 4 BBC voice on now. It's really great to be here. My first time in Washington, D.C. And I'm going to start off to get the poetry out of the way. I should probably talk about this a bit. I wrote these poems when I... Well, I was going to say when I was a student that wore black, but actually I'm kind of wearing black now, so that doesn't really... I was a miserable student who loved language, and I was a total introvert, and I sort of skulked around the place smoking cigarettes and being really, really thoroughly objectionably horrible to myself and most of my friends. And I wrote a lot of poetry, and I like it. I like these poems. I think they're really interesting, and I like how they work. They're kind of difficult and playful. But there's something about reading them that's a little bit like reading your teenage diaries to me now. So I kind of love that ambivalence. It makes reading them for me really quite fun. So I'm going to read one poem and then we'll get on to H is for Hawk. And this is a poem called Mine. And it's a kind of war poem, I guess. Although, like all of these poems, it's not a particularly straightforward narrative. Mine. The aim is fine-tune gradual. The piece of heavy rain is owned, blinked to set resuscitation of vision, flashes of brilliance distant, maybe recede, he is carrying dust. And his certainty was no one wished themselves to accompany him, dismissing the ground as level, discussing its ease of use. No, we will not hurt. The ground will fade into beauty as easily, and the hasp of the air with lead, as the figure of one who is carried by another, sand blowing through the wide, broken streets where frames are weak near the ocean, warm grey air slides up the riverine edge, condensing on the grains, making them cohere. The figures persevere as differences in structure emerge. Distortions in vision induced by the sun. We could call them mirages rather than justifiable blunders of suspense. Now the figure is moving, and we deduce his plan from our own. Under stands of palm, the rattle of darkness held in Pandanus rags hardly seems possible. This pool here, brilliant calm, is walking towards it, as if every imagined harm discarded the tiny surface tension of chlorinated warm blue and left it alone, the weakest thing peeling from the surface in long chains by the sun, plotting the destruction of some moment and time, movement, or its creation, the same, witnessing the arc of evaporative calm, watching the sand, the witless climb, the moving pool, the waterfall of glass, sun below fire, the returning man. Ooh. Right, got that out the way. Good. They're poems, I hope they're poems that reading them out loud seems to close down the meanings. They're meant to be kind of sort of quite open poems. So have fun with them if you buy the book. I certainly had fun with writing them and reading them again. So the book, yeah, this was a bit of a shock when I wrote this book, which involved a lot of crying over my desk, as what happens when you write a book, hiding under the desk at one point when my editor rang saying, "Where is it?" I thought a few people would read this book, and I've been quite freaked out by what happened next. I didn't expect to be here with you good people. I thought it was a book about a miserable woman, a dead author, and a bird. You know, it's not a good hard sell, really. But it seems to have touched a chord, and I'm deeply grateful for anyone who has read it, and thank you. So what I'm going to do is just talk through the story of the book to anyone who hasn't read it, and give a few readings, and then you can grill me afterwards with the questions. I'm not going to talk too much about one facet of the story, which is the life of T.H. White. I'm sure many of you have read The Sword in the Stone and The Once and Future King, those incredible reworkings of the Arthurian myth for the 20th century. And Mr. White tried to train a hawk in the 1930s and made a terrible job of it, for reasons that were kind of the same as mine, in that he saw the hawk as a mirror of himself. Different mirror, different self. And he didn't know what he was doing. And I didn't want my book to be a kind of simple story that was, I know how to train a hawk, and this man didn't. But I wanted to kind of, his story was instructive. It was instructive about the way we use the natural world to fulfill our own needs. So I wanted to put him in there. But again, do ask me questions about him. I'll talk about him forever if you let me, so feel free. So the book really starts, actually, rather painfully, in 2007, yesterday, on the 20th of March 2007, when I got a phone call from my mum. I was about to go out for dinner, and she said this one phrase. She just said, "I had a phone call from the hospital, from St. Thomas's Hospital, and I knew my father had died, and I fell apart." He was a dear, dear friend of mine, as well as being my dad. We were both total geeks. We were nature geeks. We used to go for walks together when I was small with binoculars, you know, and we used to collect things. We'd come back with bags of shells and feathers and spread them all over the table, and Mum would be rolling her eyes at us. He was a lovely man, and suddenly he was gone. And none of us knew he was even slightly ill. He had a massive heart attack. And I kind of fell apart, as you do after a big, particularly a big first bereavement. And some strange things started happening. The main strange thing that happened was I started dreaming about goshawks. This is not a normal response to grief, as far as I know. I haven't met anyone else that's done this. But there was one goshawk in particular that I kept dreaming about, and I'm going to read this little bit from the book, which describes this moment. And it was when I was working in a bird of prey centre in England, and where there are still some wild goshawks, and this bird had hit... I think it hit a tree or a fence or something. When they're hunting, they go into this kind of berserker mode, and they lock on like the sort of radar, and they just sort of hit things. They're completely and utterly hopeless in many ways, goshawks, when they're on the hunt. It's the number one cause of death for trained goshawks, I think, is hitting things when they're chasing rabbits. Idiots. But this woman had put this bird, which was unconscious, in a box, and then it woke up and she was completely terrified and decided to take it to the centre and say, "Please, can you deal with this? I don't want anything to do with it." And we wanted to check it to see it was okay. So this is what happened. We congregated in a darkened room with the box on the table, and the boss reached her gloved left hand inside. A short scuffle, and then out into the gloom, her grey crest raised and her barred chest feathers puffed up into a meringue of aggression and fear, came a huge old female goshawk. Old because her feet were gnarled and dusty, her eyes a deep fiery orange, and she was beautiful. Beautiful like a granite cliff or a thundercloud. She completely filled the room. She had a massive back of sun-bleached grey feathers, was as muscled as a pit bull and intimidating as hell, even to staff who spent their days tending eagles. So wild and spooky and reptilian. Carefully we fanned her great broad wings. One of the things that's going to happen as I do these readings is I'll start doing the actions. So I'm really sorry about that. I'll start flapping my arms and stuff. I'll just have to bear up with me. She turned her head round to stare at us, unblinking. We ran our fingers along the narrow bones of her wings and shoulders to check nothing was broken along bones light as pipes. We checked her collarbone, her thick-scaled legs and toes and inch-long black talons. Her vision seemed fine, too. We held a finger in front of each hot eye in turn. Snap, snap, her beak went. And then she turned her head to stare right at me. locked her eyes on mine down her curved black beak, black pupils fixed, and then, right then, it occurred to me that this goshawk was bigger than me and more important. And much, much older. A dinosaur pulled from the Forest of Dean. There was a distinct prehistoric scent to her feathers. It caught in my nose, peppery, rusty as storm rain. Nothing was wrong with her at all. We took her outside and let her go. She opened her wings and, in a second, was gone. She disappeared over a hedge, slantwise, into nothing. It was as if she'd found a rent in the damp Gloucestershire air and slipped through it. That was the moment I kept replaying over and over, and that was the recurring dream. From then on, the hawk was inevitable. So I have a niece called Amy, who's 12, nearly 13, and she has got some obsessions. She currently is obsessed with Minecraft and Taylor Swift, which are pretty sound obsessions to have, I think, with your 12-year-old girl. My obsession was not anywhere near so healthy. I was obsessed with hawks, to the point... You know, this is a very un-British book in the sense that I'm kind of put it all out on the table. It's quite emotionally open. But of all the things that I talk about myself in this book, the one thing that I'm still embarrassed about is that I confess that when I was small, I tried to sleep with my arms behind my back like wings because it was like a hawk. I still find that excruciating that I mention it. But I really, really was obsessed. My friends all had pictures of rock stars on their walls. I had pictures of kestrels. So I wanted to be a falconer. And my parents were extraordinarily supportive. I think only twice did my mother say, "Are you sure you wouldn't rather be a lawyer?" So they took me to falconry centres and I kind of clung to the wire and watched these birds. And when I was 12, I got my first kestrel, way too young to get a bird of prey. You know, that was a terrible idea. But I called her Amy and she used to sleep in my bedroom bookcase. And I flew a lot of birds over my life. I flew a lot of falcons. I flew in gerfalcons and peregrine falcons and all sorts of things. But I never, ever, ever wanted to train a goshawk because basically... and my friend here is also a falconer, will tell you, they have this reputation as being basically the kind of bird world's Christopher Walkens. Yeah. They basically are total psychos, with really highly strung psychos, who are out there for blood and murder and death, and they're terrified of everything, and they're really hard to train, and only, like, really kind of, you know, big guys train goshawks. And I bought into all this stuff, you know, and I thought, I don't want one of those. And there's a bit in the book where I talk about this guy saying to me, "You know where you are with a goshawk. You know, if they're acting up and they're not behaving well, you just get them to kill stuff and then they calm down." And I'm like, oh, and then my father died and they were all I could think about. I mean, genuinely, I was obsessed. So I did something I don't recommend. I bought a goshawk on the internet. That sounds worse than it was. I knew the breeder. All the birds of prey used in Britain in falconry are captive bred. And I knew he was a respectable and reputable man. So I drove up to Scotland to pick up this hawk. And knowing that it would be a great distraction, some kind of deep distraction from my grief. And the whole thing was like a drugs deal. I was pacing up and down a quayside with £800 in my pocket, chain smoking. Sorry, I was smoking again at that point. Drinking Red Bull. And this guy came with these boxes. And I knew at that point that my life would change. And it did. So I'll just quickly read this bit, which is the bit where I see Mabel for the first time. Which was pretty extraordinary. And it's a real bit of purple prose, this. I'm trying to kind of describe what she was like over and over again and failing over and over again. And there's a bit I stole from Hamlet too, so I'm going to confess that straight away. Another hinge untied, concentration, infinite caution, daylight irrigating the box. Scratching talons, another thump and another thump. The air turned syrupy, slow, flecked with dust, the last few seconds before a battle. And with the last bow pulled free, he reached inside, and amidst a whirring, chaotic clatter of wings and feet and talons and a high-pitched twittering, and it's all happening at once, the man pulls an enormous, enormous hawk out of the box. And in a strange coincidence of world and deed, a great flood of sunlight drenches us, and everything is brilliance and fury. The hawk's wings barred and beating, the sharp fingers of her dark-tipped primaries cutting the air, her feathers raised like the scattered quills of a fretful porpentine. That's from Hamlet. Two enormous eyes. My heart jumps sideways. She's a conjuring trick, a reptile, a fallen angel, a griffin from the pages of an illuminated bestiary, something bright and distant like gold falling through water. A broken marionette of wings, legs, and light-splashed feathers. She's wearing jesses, and the man is holding them, and for one awful long moment, She's hanging head downwards, wings open like a turkey in a butcher's shop, only her head is turned right way up, and she is seeing more than she has ever seen before in her whole short life. Her world was an aviary, no larger than a living room, and then it was a box. But now it is this, and she can see everything. So, yeah, I put the bird in the car. Actually, it's quite bad. When I drove away, I discovered that I saw the breeder surrounded by armed policemen. He wanted to know what was going on, and I just kept driving. He was fine. It's all very, very... lots of bureaucracy. Then I withdrew to my house and then became this... set upon this very, very ancient art. You know, we're talking 6,000 years old, really. One of the oldest human-animal relationships, apart from eating them. Of falconry, which is when you take this wild, undomesticated creature and you have to work very hard to let it trust you. And how do you do that? Well, to start with, you withdraw from the world into this kind of monkish state with drawn curtains, and you sit there with a gift of sort of raw steak in your gloved hand with the bird there, hoping it will eat. Actually, raw steak is quite good to train all sorts of people, all sorts of things to like you, including people. Cook it first. But I went into this really, really strange meditative state with this bird. I told my friends to leave me alone. I sort of didn't really speak to my family. My friends have forgiven me now, but I was into sort of radical isolation. And slowly this bird came to trust me and came to jump to my fist and fly to my fist, and I called her Mabel. There's a tradition in falconry that if you give a bird of prey a really, really intensively sort of scary name like Killer or Slayer, it will sit on a fence post and squeak at you. So falconers quite often give goshawks in particular quite cute names. I have a friend with a goshawk called Bunty, and I have another friend with a goshawk called Baby Doll, but even he's embarrassed about that and calls her BD for short. So Mabel comes from the Latin amabilis, meaning lovable or dear. And I think looking back on it, you know, that weird person that I was then, even though I wanted to cut myself off from everything and run away from myself, I guess I still wanted something to love. I don't know. It was strange. And then I had to take the bird out around my town in Cambridge and get her used to people in this wonderful falconry term called carriage, or where you walk around with a bird on your fist and expose her to all the scary sights of the modern world, like children. No. She was actually really, really okay with everything except, well, yeah, bicycles she wasn't keen on. She didn't really like big dogs, but as I say in the book, small dogs interested her for other reasons. And it was really weird. A lot of, you know, small boys would run past and shout Harry Potter at me, which really annoyed me. It's like, it's not an owl. And you know, Cambridge, I don't know if you've been, have you been to Cambridge in England? Yeah, lots of people. I'm like, it's quite an eccentric place, but there are limits. So quite often I'd hear women say to their, and dads say to their small children, don't go near the hawk lady, dear. So it was a really weird experience. The people that did talk to me tended to be outsiders. They tended to be people who were travellers, tourists. Teenage goths loved her. They really loved her. And I thought that was really interesting, that sense that I'd already gone into this other world, which was the world of otherness, of not normal. And it was a good place to be. And then came a day when she saw a pigeon come down to roost in a tree, and everything about her changed. She just became this weapon system had engaged, you know. She just looked at it, and I'm like, oh, yeah, I hadn't thought this through. I was running away from death as fast as I could because this hawk seemed to me to represent life, vital, living in the moment, in the present moment, life. You know, she was so full of life and joy. Hawks kill stuff. So, and I realised I'd let her hunt. That's what falconry is. That's what I was going to do. And I just sort of hadn't really thought through what that would mean to someone who was grieving. And what it meant was absolutely, it was absolutely extraordinary. I remember the first time I took her out for her to chase animals, everything just sort of stopped. Weird things happened to time. I watched her. Actually, I might read out that bit. Again, it's again slightly... You'd have thought by now that I would know where everything is in this book. La, 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 la. Nearly there. This is really embarrassing. I'm being filmed as well. I'm going to really freak out. So this is me sneaking around. There was a lot of poaching that year, inadvertent and not inadvertent. One of the things that's great about being here is it's very unlikely there are any local landowners in the audience who want to have a word with me about their pheasants. So thank goodness for that. So Seriously, one day I was in Norfolk, actually doing a talk in Norfolk, and I joked about Norfolk is a very, very rich part of England where everyone shoots pheasants, and I made the joke about poaching, and there was dead silence. It was a disastrous thing to have said. So I'm sneaking around. I've got this hawk who suddenly becomes something very different from the cute bird that used to watch TV with me from the sofa. Grief had spurred me to fly the hawk, but now my grief was gone. Everything was gone except this quiet sylvan scene into which I intended to let slip havoc and murder. Nothing dies in this bit. It's okay. I'm going to move that. I stalked around the edge of the wood, crouching low, holding my breath. My attention was microscopically fierce. I'd become a thing of eyes and will alone. Mabel held her wings out from her sides, her head snaking, reptilian eyes glowing. It felt like I was holding the bastard offspring of a flaming torch and an assault rifle. Soft grass underfoot. One hand out to steady myself, we picked our way around to the final corner, and then I slowly extended my gloved fist out from the screen of brush. The hawk left the fist with the recoil of a .303 rifle. I stepped out to watch, saw a chain of events so fast they snapped into a comic strip, frame, frame, frame. Frame one, goshawk spluttering from the fist in bars and pinions and talons. Frame two, goshawk low to the ground, grass streaking along under her, chocolate wings beating strongly, hump-backed. Frame three, rabbits running. Frame four, the pheasant too, crouching and running into the woods' safe margin, but it wasn't safe. Split-second ink-starred decisions in the hawk's tactical computer. She slewed round slingshot-style, heel-bow, soaking up G-force like a sponge, closed her wings and was gone. Sucked into the black hole of the wood, beneath a low-hanging larch branch. Everything disappeared. No rabbits, no pheasant, no hawk. Just a black hole in the wood's edge. It had gone very quiet. There was the distant cock-cock-cock of a scared rooster pheasant. I have to work on my pheasant impersonations. I still can't. I should really just go for it, shouldn't I? But I get embarrassed. So yeah, so this thing happened where time just sort of stood still when I was training the hawk. I didn't really feel like a human anymore. And basically what had happened was I wanted to be the hawk. I mean, it sounds really overblown now, but that's what I wanted to be. I wanted to be this creature that lived in an eternal present, that was solitary, that was self-possessed, that didn't have any human emotions. And imaginatively, I spent so much time with her, and I saw the sort of countryside through her eyes, I thought, that I began to lose sight of who I was. And what happened was I began to drift into what I didn't recognize was a very serious depression. And it was a very unusual depression for me. I mean, I had bad times before, but this depression didn't feel like depression. It felt like the world was very complicated, very beautiful, searingly so. I was watching the bird catch rabbits, and I'd have to put them out of their misery in front of, you know, I'd have to do the coup de grace, because goshawks just start eating when they catch stuff, and I couldn't really let that happen. So I was killing a lot of stuff too. It was all very dark and made me feel very accountable and responsible. But basically, I'd wake up in the morning and my pillow would be soaking wet, and I'd think, I have some eye disease. I'd been crying all night in my sleep. I began to avoid people even more radically. I remember once hiding behind the sofa when the mailman came to the door. You know, I was turning into a goshawk in ways that were really not doing me any good at all. And there's a bit in the book where I talk about some amazing research done by an anthropologist called Rane Villeslev, who did some work in Siberia with people there called the Yukage people. And they have this hunting tradition, which is amazing. What the hunters do is they dress up in reindeer skins, caribou skins, and to hunt caribou. But it's not just dressing up in the skins. They do something to themselves that makes them assume some part of a caribou's soul. It's a weird sort of imaginative movement, and it seems to work, because if you do that, you go out into the landscape and the caribou will see you, and apparently they just come towards you. This doesn't end well for the caribou, obviously, but and there's a very poignant story about a man tracking a herd of caribou and getting lost and finding himself in a strange village where the villagers gave him lichen to eat, which I think should have been a bit of a giveaway, actually. And he began to forget things. He began to forget, he knew he had a wife, but he couldn't remember her name. It's really poignant. And then he fell asleep and dreamt that he was surrounded by reindeer, and woke up and he was, and realized what had happened, and fled home screaming, you know. So I mean, these stories don't fit in our Western understandings of attachment theory and Freud and Winnicott and Klein, but they fit what was happening to me. I'd become a hawk too much in my own mind, and it was imperiling my soul, to a better way to put it. So, and this all became clear to me when I went to my father's memorial service, which was like this, only in a church. And everyone was wearing black, and they knew my dad. And I realised I'd made this great mistake. I'd bought into this thing that all the nature books tell you to do, the big romantic tradition, which is that when you're broken, when you're suffering or unhappy or grieving, you just go into nature and it's this place of infinite solace and renewal. It will heal you. There's truth in that, but typically I'd gone way too far. I'd lost myself in it. So I went to the doctors and, yeah, that was a really weird experience. I'll just read this bit. I have scared myself. I go to the doctor. I drive to the surgery with no hope of rescue, but I can't think of anything else to do. The doctor is a man I've not seen before. He's small, dark-haired, with a neat beard, red braces and a crumpled cotton shirt. He sits behind a wooden desk. Hello, he says. Take a seat. I sit on a chair. I look at the desk. It's oak. I think of winter trees. What seems to be the trouble? He says. I say I think I might be depressed. That some things have happened over the last few months. That my father died. I'm so sorry, he says. Then I tell him I have no job anymore and no money coming in and no house either. I didn't mention the hawk. I can only think that at that point I just thought we were the same thing, so there was no point in mentioning it, you know. Very embarrassing. I tell him more and then more, and now it's hard to stop talking. When I do stop talking, he says some words, and I can't hear them clearly because I'm watching his eyebrows. Sometimes they're frowning, but mostly they're very high. He hands me a multiple-choice questionnaire. This strikes me as grimly funny. I sit in front of it for a very long while, worrying that I'm getting the answers right. So one of the questions in this questionnaire was, do you feel you're taking less care of your personal appearance than formerly? And I'm not joking, I hadn't washed my hair in about a month. I was covered in mud and thorn scratches, and there was rabbit blood on my trousers. And I remember thinking, I don't know. Do I? Anyway, the doctor was amazing. We had this long talk, bless the NHS, and he said, why don't we try antidepressants? And I was very hesitant. But I turned a corner already. I knew that I needed to crawl back into the world that I'd left behind and see my friends and family and make an effort and stop being a bloody hawk. So I started taking these things and I kept flying the hawk and things got better. There was an extraordinary moment one morning where I looked at the sky, and I always used to look at the sky in the mornings when I flew the hawk and think, right, what's the temperature, what's the wind direction, precipitation, you know, it's like kind of aviator's eye for flying the hawk. And one morning I woke up and looked at the sky and thought, right, it's going to rain, blah, 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 cold front. And then I stopped and I thought, that's really beautiful. And I think that was the moment when I knew that it was going to be okay. So I kept flying my hawk right the way through to the end of that season. But the world had changed. Mabel taught me an awful lot of things. It isn't a simple story like, you know, I was really sad and then I got a cat and then everything was okay. It's not like that. If you've read the book, you'll know that the hawk took me to very dark places. But we came back together. And as that wonderful introduction said, what became really apparent to me was that I made that mistake of using the hawk as a mirror of myself. We do it to nature all the time unconsciously. We use it to prove our own understandings, our own needs to ourselves. I saw the hawk as a mirror of my own grief. But the great joy of Mabel was that she was nothing like me. And once I'd realized that, once I'd come out of this terrible self-absorbed, grief-stricken kind of state, because grief does make you self-absorbed. I can't help do that. I realized that I had this treasure in my house, this bird from this whose world was utterly different from mine, and yet we played together, we watched TV together, we went hawking together. There was a space between us that was one of difference, that was what I realized was the great treasure, the great thing that the hawk taught me was how to love difference. And everything was kind of okay after that. So I'm going to stop there, and thank you very much. Thank you. You know, when I started doing this, I remember these talks. I'd heard actors say stuff like, good audience tonight. And I used to think, what does that mean? Now I know. And you guys are amazing, so thank you. Thank you very much. Okay,
we can take questions here or right over there.
This is always nerve-wracking.
Well, I don't know if I understood correctly, having read the book. You've alluded to it several times about the bird being a killing machine, and you were both kind of absorbed into it and revulsed by it.
Yeah.
How did you reconcile
it? Well, not revulsed. How did I reconcile it? I mean, it's a really interesting situation. Revulsion isn't the right word. I think what happened there was, I mean, we don't see death anymore. We don't see it. It's behind walls. It's not something we encounter generally on a day-to-day basis, which is kind of a new thing, I think, in human lives. When the hawk caught stuff, when she was flying or chasing things, I felt transported. I felt I was kind of on the wings of the bird. Everything was gone apart from just being this kind of creature in my mind. When she caught something like a rabbit or a pheasant, I had to get in there and, as I said, put it out of its misery very quickly. And every time I did that, I had the extraordinary sense of accountability and responsibility. You know, this is a very serious thing. None of those things, deaths, were ever taken lightly by me. And I used to eat the food, eat these things with the hawk. Obviously, she ate her bit raw and I ate my bit cooked. I got quite sick of rabbit, actually, to be honest. But there was a very weird and very painful trick that was going on there, and that was the only times I ever felt human at that point, when I was killing animals. Now, that is very dark. So I think that sense that it made me feel responsible for my actions was the only time in that period when I did feel like that, and it was very addictive. So that was very, very dark indeed. But I have no regrets about hunting with that hawk. I think keeping a hawk and not letting it hunt is a bit, as I say in the book, it's like having a kid and saying, yeah, but I'm not going to let it play. I mean, that's what they're made of. So I had no moral qualms whatsoever about that. I went to Canada a while ago, and there was a sort of dinner in honour of the book, and they served rabbit, and I was sort of pushing it around the plate like... It's really, I just couldn't do it. So, but yeah, it was a very serious thing. Thank you. It's a good question. Oh, there's a queue of people. Hello.
Hello. Thank you very much for your wonderful talk.
That's a pleasure.
Forgive my suburban upbringing, but why would anyone who loves nature tame a bird?
Why would anyone that loves nature tame a bird? Well, I guess because it's an extraordinary thing. Falconry, if it's done right, and that's saying if it's done right, because obviously there are bad falconers, there are bad parents. I just think of it as being one of the most enlightened animal-human relationships possible. Mm. Because every time you go out with this bird, obviously it can fly away. It's not like there's no coercion involved. It's entirely on the bird's terms. And you get to share a very intimate personal space with a bird in a way that is very difficult to do in any other way, I think, unless the bird is properly captive and in an aviary or in a cage. And I wasn't interested in that. I wanted to see this bird do to be a bird, right? So that's what I think of falconry. I think of it as a way of being in the wild and sharing the life of a bird of prey in a way that is, I hope, enlightened and for both sides. People often think of falconry as being this sort of, it's like domination of a wild creature. And in fact, you know, in a practice, it's very, very, it's marked by this kind of trust on both sides. In fact, in early modern Europe, when falconry was a really big deal amongst the aristocracy and kings, I read a paper recently that said that one of the reasons it was such a visible display of aristocratic power, because everyone knew that if you mistreat a hawk, if you don't govern it correctly, it will fly away. So these aristos were showing off that they knew how to, you know, govern wisely. Obviously, they also enjoyed going out with their horses and showing off, you know, the riding and stuff. So I think it's a really interesting thing to, on the ground, to kind of think about, that it's because I love hawks. And I'm a birder, a very keen birder as well, and I find there's a lot of suspicion on both sides. But both birding and falconry are founded on this deep love of birds. So I hope, you know, yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I hope you don't mind if I engage in just a little bit of amateur analysis, but having having read the book and now having seen you here, I am not at all surprised to learn that you are so interested in falconry. You have an intensity about you in your manner of talking,
the way you read
that poem, the way the words tumbled out of you with great focus. It is exactly the quality that I associate with a falcon.
Well, there's quite a lot of adrenaline and caffeine involved as well. But thank you. I appreciate it.
Well, I would like your reaction to that. And just to tie this in, do you think T.H. White had that focus too?
Okay. That's a bit of a killer two-part of that one. People have always said I'm a bit like a hawk, yeah. Particularly, there was a very funny interview after my book won a big prize in London, and I couldn't sleep. I was so full of excitement and adrenaline, and I played computer games on my phone. And then I went to this interview. I drank like 4 pints of coffee. And this guy said, "You're just like a hawk. You're really intense." I was like, "I haven't slept. Drunk my coffee." So But yeah, I get nervous in front of people, and I mean, it's kind of, I guess it's my persona, but I'm not always like this, I promise. I'm quite quiet a lot of the time. T.H. White's focus. T.H. White, I don't know, T.H. White had, was a very, very, I have a lot of compassion towards him. He was a man that grew up in you know, in a very bad time. He was gay, which is, it wasn't a brilliant time to be gay. It was like 1906 he was born. He had a horrendous upbringing with very violent parents who sent him to prep school, you know, the proper English tradition of sending your small child to a school where they're beaten every night. Brilliant, brilliant effects, as usual. And he always felt enormous shame for who he was, and the hawk for him was a way of escaping it. And I think the problem with the Goshawk, the book he wrote about it that makes it so poignant, is that like I saw the hawk as a mirror of my own grief. He saw the hawk as a mirror of him, his own self, many different sorts of his own self. And when you read it, he's basically fighting himself in the person of this hawk. And often you don't even feel there's a hawk there. It's like him punching a mirror. And I think the focus in that book is on himself rather than the bird. I like to think that I was more focused on Mabel than myself. Maybe I'm wrong, but I think White was a bit more broken than I was. But an amazing writer.
Thank you.
Hello. Oh, the other microphone. This is very exciting.
Hi. Your prose is brilliant. It's never purple. And snippets from
you.
Hamlet sit gladly within it. And because the story is so inward and so complex and the book is so language-centered, would you like to see it translated into a feature film? And if so, what actress would play you?
Guess what's happening next week, guys?
Oh.
I have meetings in LA. I am terrified. I've been told I have to wear big dark glasses and then sort of go in and... Yeah, it's amazing. And I can tell you guys now that the rights were very early on bought by... do any of you watch Game of Thrones?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know the evil Queen Cersei?
Yeah.
Lena Headey has bought the rights. And I think she wants to play me, which is very flattering. I had a long conversation with her on the phone, and she gets the book totally. She's very funny, very witty, completely and utterly, like, gets the story and the emotional weight of it. And it looks like it might go ahead. And it's obviously, it's, you know, the thing about adaptations is that you can't keep hold of the book. I can't, you know, you need to give it to someone else, like a cake or something. Here it is. Do what you want with it, as long as you do the birds right. So we'll see. But it's very exciting. I'm probably more terrified of this meeting than I am of the film, actually. I don't So watch this space. Thank you. Hi.
Hi. First, I just think that that's really funny about Lena Headey, because I can't think of a more hawk-like actress on TV. Maybe
she has more tattoos than I do, so I feel like she's kind of cooler than me.
So I just wanted to say that I really loved the way you wrote about Mabel. And, you know, we've been writing about animals for thousands of years, and I think that there's a continuum where either you're really anthropomorphizing them, which is generally frowned upon, and then on the other end, the more scientific contingent of writing about them is, yeah, it's very clinical and we don't assume anything about them. So I thought that you had this really happy medium where you describe her really beautifully and the affection that you have for her comes through really clearly. So I just wanted to know, did you find that came to you really easily? Did you sort of struggle with writing about her because, you were so close to her? I'm really curious about that.
She was the easiest thing to write about in this book. I found writing about her really easy. Most of the stuff about her and about watching her fly and hunt was written straight out. Stuff about me, much harder. Mm-hmm. Spell the telling, I suppose. I think that's a really interesting question for lots of reasons. I think, you know, I was trained as a historian of science and to some extent as a philosopher of science. And this question of, you know, scientific descriptions of animals on one side or anthropomorphism on the other, these are all stories that we're telling about animals, including science. It's just another way we're talking about the natural world. It's, you know, it has kind of connotations of truth and sort of, you know, accuracy, but at the same time, it's still caught up in the cultures in which we live. So what I wanted to do with this book was to try and find a middle ground between those two things. And the only way I could do that was to just... this is going to set radical honesty about what it felt like to be with the bird. Because of course I was anthropomorphizing her, and of course I was using scientific kind of text, you know, distinctions to describe her. All those things are part of all the stories we talk about hawks with. So I just thought I'd just, you know, do my best to try and get them all down. And then, but but try and push the big message that all the stories we tell about the natural world are to some extent about us, and that's what the book's about. So, yeah, but Mabel was super cool. I miss it a bit. She passed away a couple of years ago very suddenly, and I still have a big jar of her molted feathers on my desk and have a bit of a weep about her sometimes. So thank you.
Thank you.
Hi. I just loved your book, and I think especially the language was so beautiful, as well as the story. And it reminded me a little bit of the work of Annie Dillard, the American author. Wow. And because you both are very honest about the violence and the blood and the killing, but at the same time, you have this lyrical way of writing about nature. And so I wondered if you had ever talked with Annie Dillard, or if you know of her work, because I think you have a kindred spirit.
Oh, I'm getting emotional now. I've never had the honor of meeting her. I love her books, Distraction. I mean, she's extraordinary. Yeah, I mean, if I met her, I probably just wouldn't be able to speak. But I think this notion of, I sort of pick up this idea about being the particular ways of writing about the natural world is really interesting to me, because traditionally, obviously, as all of you know, nature writing has been a kind of guys' preserve. It's what blokes have been doing. Blokes? Is there even a word in DC? It's a men's game, mainly. And for many, many, you know, centuries, it's been, you know, men talking about the landscapes, the spaces that they occupy, and that women are supposed to have domestic spaces. You know, that's their world. And men are out in the natural world. And I'm really pleased that that's kind of breaking down. And Ali Dillard, of course, one of the, you know, women have always written about nature, but only in the last sort of few decades have their voices become renowned, I think, mm-hmm. in the way that they have. So there are some great new writers. And I made a lot of decisions when I wrote the book that were related to that question of gendering. And one of the things was that I didn't want the book to have one voice in it. Because I think nature writing so often is one singular, usually male voice, sort of basically going, this is what's in the natural world, and aren't you lucky to have me to explain it to you? You know what I mean, right? I mean, I love those books, but it's more complicated than that. So, and I also wanted to kind of track the way that grief shatters stories and shatters narratives. So that's one of the reasons why it was in the book. I wanted there to be more than one voice talking about the natural world. And I wanted to use technical vocabulary as well. I wanted to use jargon and not have to explain it, because I think that's also... I don't like books that talk down to readers. I like to think, you know, readers can find out stuff if they don't know it, but telling people stuff they already know is always, it's like a terrible crime in my book. So, yeah, and Annie Dillard was a huge kind of influence in that regard. She's absolutely extraordinary.
Okay,
thank you. These are really great questions.
Hello. I loved it.
Thank you.
How much time between where the book ended and when you started to write it? I gather it wasn't during the process that there was... But was this 2, 5, 10 years? What's...
Yeah, good question. I couldn't have written this book then. You know, and I've said in other places, that I think there are two kinds of books on grief. There are those books that happen in it, like the wonderful Annie Dillard, I'm going to bring it, Joan Didion book, The Year of Magical Thinking, an extraordinary book. If you haven't read it, you should definitely read it. But it's written right in that intense... battlefield of recent grief. I couldn't do that. I needed time, and it took about 5 years for me to feel sufficient distance from not just from that time, but from the person I'd been, to be able to write myself in that book as something like a character. But oddly enough, I remembered everything, and I think that grief often gives you this weird power of recall. Everything's crystalline clear in my... I mean, I have terrible memory, but I remember everything that year. Yeah, she's a character in the book now. And quite often when I was writing it, I'd get furious with her for being an idiot. But I think, you know, that when I finished the book, you know, people sort of say, was it grief work writing this book? You know, was it a psychological kind of project? And I said, no, I didn't think it was. And then I pressed the last kind of key stroke to finish it. And I felt very weird and sick and a bit dizzy, because I realized it was saying goodbye, not just to my father and to those times, but to the person I'd been. And that was a big deal. So, yeah. It took a while.
How long did it take you to write?
A year and a half, full time, with a lot of, yeah. I always, you know, days were crying. There were days where I thought I was the best writer in the world. There were days where I couldn't write anything. And I just thought, oh, I'm such a bad... And I discovered that everyone is like this when they write a book. It's not just me, so I didn't feel too bad about it. It's a very up and down process. And sometimes it feels like the book's writing you. It's a very weird conversation with the art you're creating. Thank you. That was great. Hello.
Hi. Two small practical questions. In the book, you describe you have one gloved hand, but in your petting the hawk with the other hand.
Yeah.
Why doesn't she turn around and rip your hand off?
Why would she?
Well, I don't know.
Right.
But she was so antsy.
She was terrified of me to start with. So, if I'd put my hand up, she would have just tried to get away from me because I was a monster. Mm-hmm. Slowly, she realized that this is the hand that, you know, feeds her.
Yes.
So the only time that I ever got injured by Mabel were times when I made a mistake, where I'd sort of by mistake put raw meat in this hand, bare hand, near her feet when she was hungry. And of course, she just grabbed it.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, being grabbed by a goshawk is a bit like sticking your hand into an electric light socket. It's this famous phrase from Steve Bodio. It's very painful. But goshawks have no guile. They're incredibly honest birds, and she had no desire to hurt me at all. They're very gentle. I have a parrot now. My friends tell me it's emotionally more healthy, but I'm not sure. You know, if you upset a goshawk, you just upset it, and after a while it will forgive you, and then you feel terrible. If you upset a parrot, it gets vindictive. Because it's a social animal. It understands social kind of, you know, how behavior. But goshawks are these solitary things that they don't understand, you know, kind of lying or deceit or any of those things. So very honest to work with. So, yeah, she didn't want to hurt me.
Okay. And the other question is, I tried to picture this house you were in when you were manning.
Yeah.
And that's the word, right?
That's the word, yeah. Like, no one ever be – there's definitely gender aspects to falconry, yeah.
Yes, all right. Okay. Was it a very small house?
Okay, so the house I was in is nothing like the house I'm in now. I'm in a tiny house now that I own. This was a college house. Cambridge University is very wealthy. And it was a three-story Georgian townhouse in the middle of Cambridge that I rented for £300 a month. So, you know, I was super privileged to be in this house. And, of course, I had a hawk in it. And I wasn't supposed to because there was a strict no pets regulation. And people sometimes say, wasn't it messy? I was like, yep. So what I did was I got a huge vinyl tablecloth. It was green with white spots. Yes. And I basically taped it to the whole floor so that when she, you know, muted in the wonderful falconer's parlance, I could just wipe it up. And that's how it worked in the house. And then she would go in the garden when it was sunny. And, you know, it was actually pretty good. I just to say, a few months ago, my brother and his wife bought a new tablecloth.
And
it was the same material. And I went to dinner with them, and I just found it really hard to eat off it. I just couldn't do it. Yeah.
So. They should have served rabbit.
Yeah. Thank you. Any more questions? This is fun. I'm enjoying this. I had a 5-year-old boy once, for some reason, was at one of my talks. I don't know what parents thinking, actually. And he stood up, and at the end, he said, I have a question. You know, and he stood on the chair. And I said, yes. And he said, what was the biggest animal Mabel ever murdered? And I was like, you know, be honest to the children. So I said, it was a big rabbit. And he was so disappointed. I think he thought I would say a horse or something, you know. It was just like, he just ignored me for the rest of the evening, you know. Any more? I feel like an auctioneer. Any more takers? No? Okay.
Oh,
no,
wait.
There's one more. This has got this wonderful sort of game show element to it. I'm really enjoying this.
Hi.
Hello.
I listened to the audiobook, which you read, and I don't think that many authors do their own audiobooks. What was it like for you doing that? Did you practice? Did you have to do retakes, or did you just?
Yeah, there were retakes.
Listening to you read here, you're obviously a natural.
Well, I asked to do it actually, and I asked to do it partly because I just in a sort of slightly arrogant way, I thought, oh, actors are going to get the falconry terms wrong. Hadn't really thought that through, really, because recording a book is pretty intense. It was 4 days of talking at a microphone from 9 a.m. till sort of 5:30 in the evening. And obviously, if you listen to it, you'll see there are bits where I get kind of like, you know, like that guy from Independence Day. David! By day three, I had to drink raw honey to actually get the words out. I remember saying to the wonderful producer, I mean, this was taking place in a tiny studio, that the bit I was in, the booth I was in, was about the size of this table. And it was on an industrial estate in Oxford, like a kind of little tiny place by the river. And it was quite funny because outside there was a kind of a wholesale butchery warehouse that had a Christmas sale on. It was Christmas time, and it was snowing. And there was a man outside the butchery warehouse all day, dressed as a snowman, playing the trumpet to bring people in. And I could have come out and have sort of cigarette breaks, which didn't help, to be honest with the talking. And by the end of the day, I couldn't speak, and he couldn't hold a tune, so we had this kind of bond going. It was great. But it was really interesting. I mean, it was an interesting thing to do, and tiring, and oddly much more emotionally taxing than I thought it would be to read out that book from beginning to end. It was hard to do, but I'm glad I did it now. I mean, it was a good thing to do.
I'm glad you did it also.
Thank you very much.
My question has to do with something that puzzled me a little bit as I was reading the book, and it's about grief. And, you know, obviously it's intensely personal in your relationship with your father, but you also mention your mother and your brother, and it seems like
they're not
the natural
in the book very
thing, you know,
much,
those are the other two people who have experienced that very personal loss. And I'm wondering about your decisions as a writer to
not write
somewhat
about them.
omit them from the story.
It's a really, really important point, actually. Any memoirist, anyone who's written about anything, actually, knows that there are things that you can't put into books if there are living people around. When I wrote this book, I sent the manuscript to my mother and my brother, and I said, you know, if you don't like it, I'm not publishing it, which would have been really awful, actually, for all sorts of reasons to do with contracts, but, you know. And my mum read it and said, don't change a word, and my brother too, for which I'm hugely grateful. But I made some decisions when I was writing this book, and one of those decisions was to not talk in depth about my father's life and him. He was a very intensely private man, and he felt that his photography, he was a press photographer, would stand for him. That was his legacy, and I wanted to respect that. And, you know, during this time, I spoke to my mother and my brother all the time on the phone, but I just thought that didn't materially affect my isolation, physical isolation or mental isolation at the time. But we're very, very close. And I just didn't want to tell their stories for them. So if there is something in this book that has been shaped that is misleading or odd, it is that I haven't talked at length about my mother and my brother, who are wonderful. So, yeah, that's the old memoirist's artistic license there.
Thank you.
Thank you. Oh, there's more people. This is great.
Question?
So I wonder if you've told the parrot about Mabel. And
I'm not sure the parrot would understand.
We're withholding information.
I'm withholding, yeah.
And then would you get another hawk?
Interesting. Good question. The parrot and the Mabel, I mean, if I get another hawk, the parrot and the hawk, different rooms at all times. Because the thing is about the parrot is that, you know, if I have friends over to my house, which I still do, I do have friends, the bird just thinks they're part of the flock that I'm in, so it'll come and say hello. And I think the same would happen with a bird of prey, and that would be very bad for the parrot. Or possibly the hawk, because I think the parrot's got quite a nasty bite on it. So, yeah, no, segregation is the only answer for birds of prey and parrots. That's the wrong word, but anyway. Another bird of prey. Yes, I don't have time now. It's an extraordinarily time-consuming thing to do, and you need a lot of land, a lot of time, a lot of dedication, and this book's surprising and bewildering success to me has kind of meant that's not possible. However, I'm hoping next year I might be able to get something again, another bird, possibly another goshawk, I don't know yet. But I miss Mabel. I mean, Mabel was one of those birds, you know, that people who have dogs know there's always one dog. There's always the one dog that was the dog, and I think Mabel was the dog. That sounds odd. Mabel was the hawk. But I'm looking forward to that again. I miss it. I was saying to Bill earlier that I think half of who I am is kind of not really a present because I'm not flying a hawk at the moment. So
Thank you.
We have a question over here.
Okay, hello.
I gave H... is for Hawk to my daughter in Boston over a year ago. And I was hoping you might be showing up there so she could come and hear you.
Oh, I did Boston last year. I did a talk in Boston this time last year.
Okay.
I'm really sorry. Another time maybe, I hope to. I love Boston.
Okay.
So.
Yeah. I was just checking the internet and I couldn't find a schedule for you.
I'm speaking in New York this coming week if she's around, but that's a bit of a drive. Yeah, I think I'll have to come back another time. But I've got friends in Maine, so I'm often coming backwards and forwards, so I might be able to do something in Boston in the future. That would be great. I'd like that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi. It's an extraordinary book.
Thank you. Thank you.
Really, it's one of the most incredible books I've ever read, really.
Wow.
And I wanted to know two questions. Who your favorite poets are, who you read, if there's anyone you've read really obsessively. And and I was trying to understand how you might have put the pieces of the book together, because I found it so interesting, the strains that you used. It seemed very conscious to me, and yet, you know.
Yeah, formally, I mean, it was hard work. You know, I wanted it to give the impression that I was just sort of thinking of things randomly, but it was a lot of work to try and fit those puzzle pieces together and make the three narratives, really, or the two narratives kind of work with each other and against each other and argue with each other. It just took time. I mean, there were certainly... A weird thing happened, and I was a little bit, when I was talking to you earlier about the sense that the book, it was like, had a life of its own. And sometimes when I was working with it, it felt like I was wrangling an animal, a half-tamed animal, but like a hawk. So there were whole chapters that I was trying to put in this book that wouldn't go in, and eventually I realized that the book didn't want them. And yet sometimes I would be writing about something, and then I'd be writing about T.H. White at length, and I didn't know why, but that's clearly what was required. So a lot of those decisions about form and content seem to be happening at a level that's beneath conscious examination. And quite often there'd be days where I'd be completely blocked and couldn't write a thing and was convinced that was it. There would be no book. And then what was happening was I was working on these puzzles without realizing it, and I'd come back and it would work again. So, yeah, I mean, it's not very helpful in the kind of writer's workshop way, but it just took a lot of time. And certainly the fact that the arc of Hawk training is obviously the same happened to both me and White, although our respective kind of abilities were different and our lives were very different, meant that there was already a kind of arc there that I could kind of work with. But yeah, I mean, I tried to track what was happening and kind of, you know, and the anecdotes and the thoughts that I was having and the revelations I was having did happen in that kind of time, that real time. So it was quite an easy book to write in that regard. But yeah, fitting the things together was hard. Oh, poets. Oh, God. well, Coleridge I love. Frost at Midnight is my favourite poem. In fact, even thinking of the title gets me welling up. There's a poet who died recently called R.F. Langley, who I've been banging on about recently. He died a few years ago, actually. His book's come out recently, Collected Poems, and he's a very quiet, very serious, experimental nature poet from England. And his work does for me what Shakespeare does. When I read it, the top of my head blows off. I mean, it's absolutely astonishing, very detailed, very careful, very generous. And his nature poems are always, they seem to be sort of founded on him looking at very small things, very tiny things, and then using them as a sort of springboard to think about life and death and art. And that sounds so precious, but there's one line of his that, just to get you an idea, he's standing on, in this poem, he's standing on a railway bridge near his house, and he sees a tiny insect. It's like a thrip. It's like the size of sort of, you know, two commas, making its way along this railway bridge while the trains go along underneath. And he thinks in this poem, where is it going? It can't possibly know what's on the other end of... It can't possibly know where it is. And then there's this line where he just goes, and it will never be seen by anyone who has words again. I mean, he's just a master, and I go on about him whenever I can. So R.F. Langley, guys, he's the don of nature poems. So, yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Well,
I think we've
reached
the end.
That was so much fun. Thank you very
much. Thank you so much, Helen. This is magical.
Live at Politics and Prose is a co-production of The Bookstore and Slate.com. For information about upcoming Politics and Prose events, visit politics-prose.com. And please let us know what you think of this program. Our email is podcasts@slate.com.